We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of Booker T. Washington, a man who, in his day, was arguably the most powerful, most influential, widely admired African-American. He made the argument that economic independence and moral improvement were the keys to success for black Americans. For most of his life, maybe there might have been some change in this late in his life, but even at that point, and for a couple of decades after his death, he continued to be widely admired. And yet, at one point, his character came under attack, particularly in the 1960s, at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, when people began to feel that there was really only one way to change things, and that was with direct action. At that point, the model of leadership became Dr. Martin Luther King, and Booker T. Washington was cast, in a sense, as King's polar opposite. There were people who argued that his approach was much too accommodationist to the interests of white Southerners. In fact, they even argued that Booker T. Washington had held back African Americans. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Norell. He is the author of a new biography of Booker T. Washington, the first really new biography of Washington to come along in quite a long time. And he believes that a real injustice has been done to Booker T. Washington, and intends, in part, to see if he can write that by bringing a much fuller, nuanced picture of Washington and certainly placing him in his time. The book that we're talking about is fairly recently out. The title is Up From History, The Life of Booker T. Washington. Belknap Press of Harvard University Press is the publisher, and our guest, Robert Norell, is professor of history at the University of Tennessee. Professor Norell, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I think what's really interesting here, and perhaps we could find other people for whom this would be the case, but it might be difficult to find a case of an individual who had been so widely admired at one point and then at another point be so widely criticized and condemned.
Yes, I think, of course, historical figures often see their reputation or appreciation rise and fall. It is more likely to happen, of course, in a public figure's life during his life than to be to fall into such disrepute long after he or she had died, as is the case with Washington.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, during his lifetime, how people regarded him.
Well, Washington was a controversial figure during his lifetime, and that is also an aspect of his life that has been or was forgotten in the 1960s and 70s. That is that it was a general presumption that Washington had been admired by everyone, when in his lifetime he was much disparaged and hated by white bigots in the South. During his lifetime, Washington, though, was widely admired, looked to as a wise leader by African Americans, with some exceptions. Relatively small minority of exceptions to that. White opinion was divided. I've said that white Southerners, for the most part, distrusted him and disliked him. But other Americans outside the South, white Americans outside the South, appreciated Washington and admired what he had done with his life, and saw that he had made many remarkable achievements in the building of Tuskegee Institute and in his position as leader of African Americans from 1895 to 1915.
I think an interesting point, you talk about the fact that, in fact, many white Southerners did not support him. And at the same time, I think that there would have been a point where people criticized him because they said that here was the kind of man, because of his stress on moral improvement and hard work, and that because his approach was not confrontational, they said, well, this is exactly the kind of black leader that white Southerners, white racist Southerners, would embrace.
Well, yes, that and that became essentially an assumption in the historical memory. But if you examine carefully what happened during his time of being in the public eye from 1895 to 1915, one understands that because Washington took particular actions that that did, in fact, challenge the status quo of white supremacy, of segregation, and of disfranchisement, that many Southern whites recognized that while he often talked and always talked about reconciliation and peace among blacks and whites in the South, that his actions challenged that, because Washington really was committed to African Americans rising to ultimately to equal status in American life, even though he freely acknowledged that they were not in that condition currently and perhaps would not be for some time. But white Southerners understood that ultimately his goal was full equality for black people, and they detested him, many of them, for that very reason.
Mm. Well, and I think that there's an important point here that he believed that there was nothing would be gained by directly confronting white Southern racism. And for that reason, his strategy was different. He also, though, probably was involved in a sense in a little bit more of what we might call direct action, but he had to do this anonymously. It was a very low profile effort, again, for the same reason that it would have been dangerous and maybe even counterproductive for this to have been more open.
Yes, he lived at a time when there was absolutely no tolerance for black pursuit of equality. And Washington did take action. He filed lawsuits, supported and arranged lawsuits to challenge all manner of discrimination in the South. But he had to do this working secretively because he understood that there would be an outrage among whites for any black man, aimed at any black man who dared to challenge the status quo of Jim Crow and essentially the total demeaning of black people. And so he did it secretly. And he was not, however, secret in condemning publicly things like lynching and disfranchisement and discrimination in education and discrimination in employment. But he would make those criticisms of the treatment of African Americans carefully and without being bellicose or in a offering them in a protest angry vein. He did them quite reasonably and low-key, and for the most part got away with making the same criticisms that reasonable people would always make about black discrimination against blacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there something about the way that he did it that made that message easier for some people, for white people particularly, to hear?
Well, I think so. I think Washington had a remarkable style of public communication. Mm. He was a fantastic public speaker. Now, you know, he's living in an age when there's no electronic communication. Most of his communications were on the speaking stump or in conversation with editors and newspaper reporters. And in his presence, whites generally were impressed by his intelligence and his careful demeanor and his firmness about what he believed, and his Washington's command of current events in American life. Washington also was a masterful humorist, and so he was often able to charm white with his wisdom tempered with humor, and could, in fact, deliver a strong message with a velvet glove, in effect. So he was able to get away with making points, and ultimately to persuading some white Southerners that he was a reasonable person, and that there was a point of view about black interest that should be heard. Now, only a minority of whites were willing to hear that, because the large majority of whites were firmly and fully committed to white supremacy in every aspect of life.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Norell. He's a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and is the author of a recently published biography of Booker T. Washington, Up From History, is the title of the book, published by Belknap Harvard. It's out in the bookstores now if you'd like to look at the book. And questions here are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The title of your book obviously echoes the title of Washington's autobiography, which was Up From Slavery. And perhaps we can talk some about his early life. I think it's important that we make the point that, in fact, he was born in slavery.
He was born in slavery in Virginia in 1856, a few years, of course, before the Civil War. His real childhood memories focus mostly on the time during the war when he was a slave on a small plantation wherein he worked alongside whites and played at times with white children. One of the noteworthy things, of course, about Washington's background is that his father was white, and his father never acknowledged the paternity of Booker. That, of course, I think is a highly significant event. His mother was a remarkable slave woman, the plantation cook, a woman who had great ambition for her children, and even though she was entirely unlettered, she always tried to help Booker, who wanted more than anything else to be educated once he was freed from slavery, as they were all freed from slavery at the end of the war in 1865.
Mm. Well, it's certainly very clear that his mother was one of the most important influences in his life, and perhaps impressed upon him just how important education was, and perhaps it was for that reason that it became a major focus of his. He certainly believed that one of the keys to improvement for African Americans was education, and he certainly carried that forward in founding the Tuskegee Institute. Where did that come from, that emphasis, you think, on the importance of education? Was that truly something that for him began with his mother?
I actually don't think his mother was the one who instilled in him the desire. She was not educated and really could not fully understand what an education represented. She probably had some understanding. I think Washington's focus on education, if we follow his own recorded comments about it, stem from the recognition as a very young boy, the power that being able to read gave to an individual. He recounts seeing a young black man from Ohio reading a newspaper to a group of black people, and he had moved to West Virginia by then, and how he envied that man's ability. And I think it was largely current among emancipated African Americans in 1865 that education was the thing that they wanted most after, you know, some kind of the personal freedom that allowed them to be mobile. And so there was a general pursuit of education among the freed people. Everybody wanted to go to school almost regardless of age. And Booker, actually as a slave, had accompanied the white children on the plantation to school. He escorted them there and brought the horse home. And he knew exactly, or he had a sense of how significant that was to white people, and he wanted that. And he was fortunate enough as an adolescent to go to work for a woman in West Virginia as her houseboy, and she is a former New England school teacher, and she began to talk to him about the necessity of education and to help him acquire an education. But Booker had, an intense internal motivation to get that. He pursued it with remarkable determination, and the more he got, the more he wanted it, and the more he appreciated it.
We have a caller. I will not make them wait. We'll bring them into the conversation. Someone in Piatt County on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I'm sorry I'm not as familiar with this subject as I would like to be, but I seem to recall from the myths of my reading in the past that one of the controversies about Booker T. Washington was that he encouraged students in technical schools, and they were to be good domestics, and he thought that that's the way that they could prove themselves, that they would be good in the job that they had, and then, you know, in that way, slowly they would advance themselves, not necessarily through higher education. And I just wanted to know if that was something that I have remembered incorrectly from the past, or if that was one of the controversies about his view of the education of young people. And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure the caller remembers correctly, because it has often been taught that Washington wanted to educate black people for, you know, domestic service, that was the kind of education he approved of. And it's often been taught that way about him, but I think that is essentially wrong. Washington at Tuskegee created a school that was essentially a normal school to train teachers. That was its original creation, because that was what was needed in the South, were black people to teach primary education. But he had studied at Hampton Institute, and there the curriculum had emphasized the need to understand the basic subjects of reading and writing and arithmetic, but also to offer some instruction in a vocation that would be broadly applicable in the South. So there was some agricultural education, because most black folks were going to be farmers, but then there were also some vocational courses, carpentry and brickmaking and skills that could be widely used in society at that time. Washington took that same curriculum, a mixed curriculum of academic subjects and some manual education or vocational education, to Tuskegee. What happened, and it was always, Tuskegee was always primarily a school to train teachers. Now, over time, he started it in 1881. In the 1890s, the people who were funding black education in the South, mostly northern white philanthropists, began to insist more firmly on more vocational education. They didn't believe that academic education was worthy for blacks. And so Washington, at the same time he kept his academic curriculum in place, emphasized more and more of the technical skills. But Washington always maintained publicly, especially when he was criticized for this, that he was for any black person getting all the education they could use. And if you could use a full-blown college education to become a teacher or a lawyer or a doctor, then that was good. He supported that entirely. And but he didn't think that in 1890 or 1900 that there was a place, there were enough places in the American economy for every black person to get an academic education. Of course, very few people could afford that. A full-blown college academic education. And so he saw it as a practical matter that the curriculum had to fit both the people, black people of the South, and the current American economy.
And I suppose, you know, one could see on the one hand people making the criticism that that was his vision for what black people could achieve was limited. On the other hand, I guess in the particularly this emphasis on practical skills, I'm not sure that the idea of Tuskegee was all that far off of the idea of the land-grant university as it was developing at the time that had, in a sense, the same kind of focus.
Well, absolutely. The FOCA curricular focus in American higher education after the Civil War moved toward more practical college education away from the classical curriculum, so that you saw after the Morrill land grant in 1862 the creation of land grant schools like the University of Illinois or the University of Tennessee, where engineering and agriculture were taught and other vocational courses of study were put in place. So it was widely it was accepted. It was the emerging sort of consensus view that that was what higher education should look like in America. And Washington, in a sense, was just representative of where education was going, and it was clearly the curricular emphasis in nearly all of the black institutions that were created in the United States after the Civil War, the black institutions of higher education. So his wasn't a backward-looking position about curriculum. It was really quite the norm. But there were a few people, mainly his black critics, from the North, who used that as an instrument to flog him with, because they didn't like his, you know, his other positions, and they consistently ignored what he said over and over again, that he was for all kinds of education for black people, any education that they could put to good use.
We are at our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Norell. He is a professor of history at University of Tennessee and is author of a recently published biography of Booker T. Washington. The title of his book is Up From History. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think you could say without fear of contradiction that around the time of the Civil War, probably the most significant African American would have been Frederick Douglass, and that then when he died, there was something of a struggle for who would be the leader of black people in the United States, and I'm for sure for some people the Booker T. Washington would have been their choice. There were others. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the roots of the struggle between animosity between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and in fact, how Du Bois' assessment of Washington has influenced how people have seen Washington probably ever since.
Well, it's an interesting and really complex relationship between Washington and Du Bois. They knew each other from the early 1890s. Washington tried a number of times to hire Du Bois to come to Tuskegee to teach. Du Bois was almost from the moment he graduated from Harvard recognized as a leading black intellectual in the country, as he clearly was. Du Bois, for a variety of reasons, did not come, and I think some of them were personal, did not accept the various offers that Washington made to him. But Du Bois was a supporter when Washington gave his famous address in Atlanta in 1895. You know, Du Bois wrote and said it was a fine expression and of what black people needed to do and what black people needed to say to white people. But Du Bois and ultimately sort of made a movement away from Washington. Now, there were people all along who didn't like Washington, especially a group of black middle-class folks, most of them based in Boston and Washington, D.C., didn't like Washington from the very beginning, didn't like the emphasis on vocational education, didn't like Washington's conciliatory way toward the White South. They wanted a leader who was in constant protest against the many awful things, and they were awful, that were happening to black people in the South. Du Bois was not originally with them. In 1901, however, he broke with Washington and began to be critical of Washington in somewhat similar ways to the way, for example, that William Monroe Trotter of Boston had been for some time. The source of the break is, I think, is really not ideological, although it would become understood in those terms. It was essentially a personal break. Du Bois wanted Washington's help in getting a job in the Washington, D.C. school system. Washington, it looks to me like, did help him. He didn't get the job. He blamed Washington for it, for his not getting the job that he wanted. There were these personal conflicts that underlay, I believe, Du Bois's alienation. And by starting in 1901, he began to be critical. In 1903, when he published The Souls of Black Folk, it was a full-blown critique of Washington. And because Du Bois was such a an impressive and person, high intellect, he emerged as the anti-Washington alternative, and despite Washington's efforts to create some kind of modus vivendi, some conciliation with Du Bois strongly resisted and became, went into sort of full blown hostility. And that became, of course, important. I mean, Du Bois's attitude was probably far more, I know it was far more influential after Washington died than it was during the time that Du Bois and Washington occupied the historic stage together. That is, that some people listened to Du Bois, a few people in the North, and there were a few whites who listened to Du Bois. But during Washington's life, he maintained amazing popularity and commanded the loyalty of nearly all African Americans and a great many influential whites. Relatively few people listened to Du Bois, but Du Bois lived for nearly 50 years after Washington died, and in various writings, autobiographical writings, but also including the what he had written in 1903 in The Souls of Blackford. That became the accepted, the conventional wisdom about the error of Washington's leadership, or errors. And Du Bois's status as a figure in American life, as a black intellectual, as a protest leader, rose over the course of his life and became very influential in the 1960s with the rise of direct action protest against civil rights, by which time black leaders and white intellectuals, white historians, were looking to the past and saying, well, Du Bois was the right point of view and Washington was the wrong point of view. Du Bois was for protest, Washington was against protest. Black people and minority groups only rise in American life when they are willing to go into the street and protest. That's something of an oversimplification, but that's effectively, I believe, how Washington's historical reputation went the way that it did after he died.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that one of the criticisms that had been made of Washington was that he was favored by Southern whites because they saw him as being non-confrontational. You're saying that he certainly didn't have any kind of broad base of support among Southern white elites. And for that reason, he certainly couldn't rely on them for any kind of support, financial or otherwise, for the kind of things that he wanted to do. As a result, then he had to turn for support to wealthy, influential Northern whites, people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, which then in turn ended up getting him criticized for being associated with some of the most prominent robber barons of the Gilded Age. What can you say about that?
Well, I think that's essentially what happened. Washington and Tuskegee got almost no support from the white South, and financial support. Took a lot of money to educate 1,500 Tuskegee students every year, because none of them, for all practical purposes, could pay any tuition. He was raising $100,000 to $200,000 a year and around the turn of the 20th century, which, of course, represents a huge amount of money. He essentially did it, you know, by himself. And he had to look to the North, and ultimately, you know, it was much easier to go to Mr. Carnegie or Mr. Rockefeller, and there were, of course, many others like that. Julian Rosenwald, and there in Chicago, most notably, is another one, who could give him lots of money, you know, in one check. And so it was the practical thing to do, and those people, whites in the North, and especially men like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Rosenwald, all of whom had built great enterprises, looked at Booker Washington and said, "Hey, you know, this guy did something as impressive and probably more impressive than I did, and he did it with the huge handicap of being a black man, a former slave in the South." All those fellows, the Carnegies and Rockefellers, I mean, they were in awe of Washington and wanted to help him, and wanted to, you know, there was a sense that, you know, race was still the main problem in American domestic life. They, as the richest men, they wanted to help with that, but afterward, of course, or beginning even during his life, there was a lot of criticism of the so-called robber barons, the malefactors of great wealth, and the progressive period, the progressive animosity to that grew when, by the time we get to the Great Depression, intellectuals are deeply hostile to American capitalists like that, and the people who were writing the history of the South about the time of Washington's life, you know, disparaged him because of his association with the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the other the other people who were really the lone sources of support for black education in the South.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Robert Norell. He's professor of history at University of Tennessee, and we're talking about the life of Booker T. Washington. Our guest, Robert Norell, is the author of a recently published biography of Washington. The title of the book is Up From History. It's published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked about what happened to the image of Booker T. Washington in the 1960s when, due to the prominence of Martin Luther King, he, as an individual, really was, he became the model for a civil rights leader. And it certainly had a lot to do with the fact that at the time there was this sense that the only way things were going to change was as a result of direct action. And anything less would be accommodating the interests of those people who didn't want things to change. And that's where, at one point, I think particularly, Booker T. Washington gets cast as the polar opposite of Martin Luther King. What's interesting is I think that you have said that despite that characterization, you think that really these two men had a lot in common.
Well, I do. I argue that in the book, and there are certain obvious there are certain differences, but I think we have failed to see that there are similarities in that King talked a lot about the ability of white Americans to overcome the bigoted past, our bigoted past, and to accept black people as brothers, a kind of reconciliation, the beloved community, and that's really not quite. That's not much different from Washington's emphasis on the essential goodness of black people and white people, and that once they got to know each other, Washington said that they could be neighbors and friends and helpmates. So it seems to me there was a similarity of tone about black-white relations that has been essentially overlooked. I argue that Washington and King shared prophetic qualities. Now, this is pretty new, I think. No one doubts that Martin Luther King is a great prophet of race and reform in America in the 20th century. He was a preacher, and he prophesied what was wrong in America and what had to happen, and then to change, and what the future might be, or that there was hope for a better future. And that, of course, is persuading black people and white people that we could do better is a genius. What makes him perhaps the greatest man of the 20th century? Well, Washington did those same things too. I mean, he was a prophet in his time. Again, announcing what was wrong and what needed to change, and what black people needed to do better, and what white people needed to do better. And then he was prophetic in the sense that he argued that the future was hopeful, that times would get better if people persisted and endured. So I draw that there were similarities, but I also say, you know, there were similarities, much stronger similarities between Washington and his predecessor, Frederick Douglass, than has been recognized either. That in effect, Washington is fairly consistent in the long line of minority leadership in this country, and that we should not see him as the exception, but as a variant of what racial or group leadership needs to be in this society.
Washington, Booker T. Washington, died in 1915. He was only 59. He seemed to have a number of health problems, but also I think I get the impression reading about him that, in a sense, he just used himself up. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think so, yeah. And we don't know as much about, or they did not know as much then, of course, not nearly as much as we know about his problems. I think his health problems. I think he had a longstanding problem with probably with circulatory problems. He had probably had diabetes for a long time. He clearly had a very high blood pressure, for a long time. And he, but it went untreated until about 1911. He died in 1915. In 1911, he's 55 years old. That's a long time for circulation problems to be neglected. And and the reason that he neglected them, I mean, that's the question. Other people had noted that he, you can look at the photographs of the man taken regularly in the first decade of the 20th century and see on his face his physical decline. But Washington, was an incessant, compulsive worker. And he not only, had to raise lots of money and travel 6 months of the year doing that for Tuskegee Institute. He was the leader of the race, and when there was an occasion when black people needed to see their symbolic leader, he wanted to be there. When there was an occasion when powerful white people needed to have a black point of view represented, he was going to be there too. And he was at his best on the public stage, and the public stage was where he persuaded blacks to have hope and whites to embrace racial peace. And he just could not essentially restrain himself from meeting that the need to deliver that message until he wore himself out.
We have about 5 minutes left. We have a caller here in Chicago. We'll talk with them on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you very much. And speaking of hope, I was wondering how your views coincided or differed any great degree with the great historian John Hope Franklin, who I had the occasion to meet once.
Well, Professor Franklin was one of the historians who emerged in the 1940s, who was very critical of Washington. There was a kind of generational aspect to those people who, about of Professor Franklin's age, who came to intellectual maturity in the 1930s. And in the Depression era, there was Washington became the object of much criticism among intellectuals, black and white. And his first writing about Washington was critical in that he said Washington taught outdated skills at Tuskegee, and that was a fundamental problem in his leadership. but I don't think – I think Professor Franklin knew the black experience so well that he was less able to go into the kind of harsh criticism, almost caricaturing kind of criticism that some white historians were able to do. After all, he'd grown up in the Jim Crow South at Franklin, and he knew a lot of what Washington, he knew instinctively, I think, a lot of what Washington had to deal with in his life. So he was not out front in the condemnation of Washington, but he was not, for example, nearly as sympathetic or understanding of Washington's point of view as had been Carter Woodson or Horseman Bond, or there in Chicago, Charles S. Johnson. So, all of whom had a much keener appreciation of Washington and complained about the degradation of Washington. So.
Well, thank you very much, sir. I really appreciate your observations and points of view. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and we'll go on here to another caller here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello?
Hi, I'm a little feverish, so I forbeared calling, but it seems to me that you sort of mentioned the progressive movement of the time, et cetera, but it didn't really confront directly that Dubois was a leftist, and he had a thoroughgoing critique of World War One. We don't know where Martin Luther King's life would have taken him, because he was so young when he was shot. But his thoroughgoing critique of the Vietnam War and the war economy, and just generally, would have, makes me think that he would have gone more towards a Dubois point of view, and actually perhaps preached leftism or something, because I think the so-called robber barons were called robber barons because they were robber barons, and it wasn't and if he was subverting their money, that was the one thing, but I think there's an important chapter, you know, that's being left out here, and there's not enough time to really develop it, but I want to at least get that word in.
All right. Well, Professor Norell, you want to comment on that?
King did evolve in terms of his attitude toward Washington. He was more positive, much more positive, and as King did become in the last 3 years of his life, much more committed to a kind of democratic socialism that coincided with the general historical, the disparagement of Washington's reputation. Du Bois had not really embraced left-wing Marxist solutions during the time that he and Washington shared the historical stage. But it is clear that, you know, a left-wing perspective is going to be critical of Washington, because Washington accepted American capitalism on faith. And in our environment today, I mean, he would, from today's political orientation, he's clearly a kind of moderate or conservative capitalist. And so there was that. A lot of the people who criticized Washington's historical memory, of course, criticized it from a left-wing point of view, adapting Du Bois, but it's the later Du Bois, not the contemporary of Washington Du Bois's leftism, that the leftist point of view.
We have about a minute. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how it is, as an historian, or how anyone deals with this challenge of, when you're looking at someone like Washington or a figure from the past, to try to judge them not by our standards, but by what would have been the prevailing kind of moral standards of their time.
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I was taught in graduate school to be very hostile to Washington. But I also I grew up in Alabama, and I had a better sense of how awful the environment was in which he lived. So I was fortunate in that regard. I could develop some independent kind of empathy for the Washington circumstance. And I'd written an earlier book about Tuskegee and knew a lot about what that environment was, and ultimately came to see, well, it would have been essentially impossible for him to have done much else and survived, and that it just needed to be rethought. His historical reputation needed to be rethought in terms of, you know, what practical survival did in fact dictate in 1895 or 1915.
We will have to leave it there, because we are here at the end of the time, but if you'd like to read more about Booker T. Washington, you can look for the book we've mentioned. The title is Up From History, The Life of Booker T. Washington, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, by our guest Robert Norell. He's professor of history at the University of Tennessee. And Professor Norell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.